I'm Kara from Burlington, Vermont.
I'm Andrew from Long Island.
I'm Ben from Louisiana.
The Sound of Young America is an independent production supported by listeners like me.
You should support the show like I did.
Just visit MaximumFun.org/donate.
I'm Jesse Thorne, live on tape from my house in Los Angeles. It's The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on this show is Patrick Warburton. He spent the better part of the last 20 years spanning the worlds of film and television with a virtual lock on guileless, blithe meatheads, ranging from his current role as one of the stars of Rules of Engagement, a long-running television sitcom, to his iconic, the role that really made his career, Putty, on NBC's Seinfeld. Let's hear one of the classic Putty moments from the show. He enters Elaine's apartment wearing a particularly brightly colored leather jacket.
Hey, Ben.
Hello? Hello?
What is that?
It's my new coat.
You ditched the fur?
Yeah, I saw Jerry wearing his. He looked like a bit of a dandy. Check it out. Eight ball. You got a question. You ask the eight ball.
You're gonna wear this all the time?
All sides point to yes.
Patrick Warburton, thank you so much for coming to The Sound of Young America. It's great to have you
here, Jesse. Appreciate it, man.
I was looking at your bio, and I noticed that your mom was an actress, and I also noticed the year that you were born, and it seemed like your mom's credits ended a year or so before you were born, and I wondered whether she gave up acting to be your mom.
She did, I would say. You know, my dad's a surgeon, orthopedic surgeon. He wanted her out of the business. I think he knew what he was doing when he got her pregnant 4 years in a row. So I have three younger sisters, and we're all very close.
You grew up mostly here in Southern California. Did you grow up in the kind of life that I'm imagining for a guy who had three younger sisters and a mom who had been was a retired beautiful actress and a dad who was an orthopedic surgeon?
It sounds so grand, doesn't it, Jesse? It wasn't bad. We were in Huntington Beach, you know, and I grew up about half a mile from the beach. On the outside, it would have all looked great. You got to understand, when I was a freshman in high school, I weighed 95 pounds. I had Coke bottle glasses. I'm blind as that. These glasses you see right here go on over my contact lenses.
I don't think that's real, Patrick. I'm looking at you right now. You're about the same height as me, 6'3", 6'4", something like that. I'm guessing you go maybe 210. You're like it's an athletic 210. I do not honestly believe you being a 90-pound weakling.
I've got all of the documentation, my friend. And, you know, I was getting bussed an hour to go to an all-boys Catholic college prep school where either you were an academic or a football player, and I was neither. You know, they could recruit football players, and they touted themselves as being one of the top 10 academic schools in the country at the time. I had a straight C average, and I just didn't fit in, and up until, you know, junior year in high school when, you know, my folks let me out of that place. And I ended up going to Newport Harbor High School, which was just an awesome transition. You know, I'm, you know, ditching class occasionally to go surfing with buddies. I got contact lenses. I started feeling like a human being, but I was still terminally shy. I couldn't talk to a girl. I couldn't talk to him.
What kind of guy did you end up being by your senior year?
Directionless. I remember the speaker we had graduated from Newport Harbor. He was president, CEO, founder of Hobie Cat Industries. And he got up in front of everybody and all of our parents and said, "Listen, if you want to take a few years off and go to Hawaii, surf, do whatever you want, I highly recommend it. That's what I did. And, you know, I'm a multimillionaire." And of course, there was a collective gasp among the parents out there who hired this guy. So I went to junior college. I rode crew. I fell asleep in every class. And I got C's once again. And I couldn't make the transfer to any worthwhile university. So, you know, I guess I felt like after senior in college, I was going to go about it. I was going to go to college. I was going to try to be a marine scientist, which was real pie in the sky and never could have happened for somebody that just had the like academic demeanor, I guess.
Marine scientist is sort of that's a classic academic aspiration for a guy who actually just wants to go surfing.
Well, yeah, or swim with the fishes, you know. Yeah. Ultimately, you'd probably end up taking oil samples for an oil company, or ground samples for an oil company. I don't know. It's not going to be what you saw on television. But, and I felt like I was a narcoleptic. I fell asleep in every class, but I think that's because I was so exhausted when I got to school every day from endorphins and, you know, rowing boats. I rowed crew in college, and I hadn't discovered coffee yet. So I feel like if I discovered coffee, maybe I would have got an education.
Did you aspire to acting, or were you just so big and handsome that someone just wrote you a check and asked you to be in a movie?
No, really wasn't that way. I loved Jerry Lewis movies growing up. That inspired me also. I loved, you know, I enjoyed going in, even though my mother didn't work professionally. Once she started really having a family, she did do community theater to sort of sate her appetite there. And I would go hang out and watch her do, you know, British farces or whatnot, you know, and it was a fun place to be. I always thought, wow, what a great gig if you could actually do this. And I guess I sort of always felt like I had a perspective on everything I saw as opposed to just being able to submit to, a place whenever I'd watch a film or whatnot of suspending all, but, you know, unreality and finding myself immersed in it fully. I think I always looked at things somewhat critically and saying, well, what would I do? Or to me, it always looked like a game, you know, being an actor. How would you attack a role or do something differently?
It's the Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on this show is actor Patrick Warburton. If his name doesn't sound familiar, his voice almost certainly does. He played Putty on Seinfeld, among many other television and film roles. I was watching clips from your career on YouTube before you came over, and I came across a clip from the first movie that you ever did, this movie with the just almost comically self-parodic title of Dragonard. From, I think, 1987. And in this clip, well, first of all, tell me how you ended up getting, because it seemed like you had a sizable role in the film, which also had some other very accomplished actors and actresses in it. Eartha Kitt was in it, for example. Did not look like a good movie, I will say that.
Oh, it's just atrocious.
But how did you end up in this role?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I look at it and I'm trying to think back if I even like auditioned for this or if I just went in and took a meeting. I'm like, how could I have read, auditioned, and gotten this job? Now, obviously, that wasn't a priority of theirs. That these were sort of, you know, Mandingo exploitation, you know, canon pieces of garbage movies.
You play a white slave in the film.
Yeah.
It's sort of like, from having seen only clips in it, it is a movie that looks like someone wrote a story based on looking at the covers of romance novels and then decided to shoot a feature film with several famous people in it on VHS.
Yeah. Well, that's about it. It is, they're unwatchable. They're just about the worst movies ever made. And then I had to come to the sort of the acceptance that, you know what, they really are bad. And you like to talk about how bad they are, but you really need to own the fact that as bad as they are, you are the worst thing in it. You know, and it's you have to realize
you're no Eartha Kitt.
You got to own stuff. Well, you know, Oliver Reed, even though he's drunk every day, was still the only watchable thing in these movies.
I want to play a little bit of this scene from the film. I'm only going to play a little bit of this scene, which sincerely goes on for 5 minutes. This is you being flogged before a crowd in the movie Dragonard.
One. Two. Three.
In this scene, so I'm watching this scene on YouTube, and I happen to look down at the comments. It turns out this scene, very popular in what you might call the flogging enthusiast community. That's what we call it for public radio purposes.
Wow.
A lot of disappointment that you were wearing your shirt. Some quibbled with the sound effects in that scene. They felt that it would have been better to go with the classic whip crack sound effect, I believe was the specific complaint about that scene. But you, in that scene, they flog you. It's 100 floggings, and they flog you 100 times on camera. There's no jump cuts. There's no start with three and then go to 77.
They, like,
then
count everyone.
Yeah, they show every single one of the floggings.
Oh, God, it's just tragically awful. You know, it's so bad. It's just an exercise in masochism to yourself, I guess, to subject yourself to that, to watch it. It's just pure crap. 33.
You were in like almost every popular television program between 1987 and 1993 once. Northern Exposure and Mad About You, just a bunch of different television shows. You were a classic kind of working television actor, appearing on just a bajillion TV shows.
Don't forget Baby Talk with Scott Baio. I was Man in Bookstore in one of those.
I shan't. And Seinfeld was the role that really made you a star. And it was a role that made you a star in one or two guest appearances. Like, you did one episode in season 7 or something like that, and came back a couple episodes later, and then were gone for a while. But that was so central. You created such a stir with those two ridiculous bits.
It was fun to get that opportunity. I got to go in, and it was 2 weeks before. I was sitting on the couch with my wife watching it. It was our favorite show. We watch every Thursday night. And I remember saying, why can't I get on a show like Seinfeld? I would just die to be able to do an episode of the show. And then 2 weeks later, I got to go in and read for Jerry and Larry David. And it was for Jerry's Mechanic. It was for one episode, and really just a means to an end. It was just a guy who was Jerry's mechanic, who Jerry shared some information with him about, a sex movie use. And then all of a sudden, now he uses it with Elaine, who they both dated, and it backfires. So there really wasn't anything specific about the character. I thought, when I saw the other guys in the room, they all seemed like Tonys and Vinnies and whatnot, and I thought, well, that's not me. I got to try a different angle with this guy. So when Jerry would accuse him of saying things like, you don't even use the swirl or the twist of swirl, and David would say, well, yeah, that's right. I just thought, well, what if instead he was like, yeah, that's right. Like, he's just like really weird and sort of detached in a way. And so it was fun. It was fun to look at Jerry and Larry laughing. I couldn't help but think this was going well. And then I did it. And then a couple weeks later, they asked me to come back to do the face painter episode where we go to a hockey game. And I'm just an idiot face painter. Like, I'm insane. And that was fun. Now, the next 2 years, I couldn't come back on the show because I had already signed on as a cast regular on a show called Dave's World.
A very likable television program starring Harry Anderson, based on the comedy columns of Mr. Dave Barry, as I recall.
Yes, absolutely. Although it was rated 70th.
Yeah.
And Seinfeld was rated first. And when they were inquiring about availability, and for 2 years I couldn't do it because I was on Dave's World and they wouldn't let me out of that in any way, I had to wait till Dave's World got canceled. And then Jerry said, hey, you want to come back on the show? This is during the 9th season. And that's when I did my last 7 episodes. I only did 9 regular season episodes on Seinfeld, 10 if you include the final episode, but that was it.
I hadn't really watched Seinfeld since it was on in first run. Mm-hmm. I did. I mean, when it was on in first run, I watched it every Thursday night like every other right-thinking American. Yeah. But I recently, maybe a year ago, watched all of them. I watched them one at a time until I had watched all of them. And there is it really is two different shows. In the early days, it is a tiny show that is always turning in on itself, and it's always about something. It's very true to the idea of a show about nothing. Right. And by the end of the show, there are those who don't love the later episodes of Seinfeld, but I definitely do. It's like a song. Like it's just a crazy rhythm that they put things into.
Yeah.
And you are a striking counterpoint to that rhythm. You know, your manner of speech is so specific on the show. And everyone else is in the rhythm. And you just stop every one of those things cold every time. And I wonder whether it was you sitting in that audition that made you think like it would be just something different if I just was that, or if you had already discovered that you could just clip your speech a little bit and look intensely, just be serious, raise the stakes a little bit, clip your speech a little bit, and it would have that effect.
I'm not sure if I was that conscious of it. I've always thought that in the realm of anything, wherever you find yourself as an actor, you know, I mean, being adaptable shouldn't really be like your primary focus, you know, because socially we all need to be adaptable, obviously, and proper and courteous and all of these things. But if you're going to create a character and you're not going to judge a character and he's going to be bombastic or clueless or this or that, perhaps he's not quite as in tune in ways with everybody else's, sensibilities. I don't know. Everybody else's, way, realm.
When we come back in just a second, Patrick Warburton will finally address the issue on the tip of everyone's tongues, how he became king of the winos. That's when we come back on The Sound of Young America from MaximumFun.org and PRI, Public Radio International.
Hi, I'm Justin McElroy.
I'm Travis McElroy.
I'm Griffin McElroy.
We're three brothers. It's not a coincidence. We have a show. It's called My Brother Me. It's an advice show for the modern era. Sometimes we also take questions from the Yahoo Answer Service.
Hey, guys, how many push-ups does it take to look like a werewolf?
That's a fine question, Griffin. We'll answer that one and so much more, including questions from readers about love and navigating the waters of society. Subscribe on iTunes or get it online at MaximumFun.org.
We're brothers.
We're experts.
And we're sorry.
Production of The Sound of Young America is supported in part by the menswear blog Put This On, presenting the Put This On Gentlemen's Association. Members receive a handmade pocket handkerchief in the mail every 60 days. Gift memberships available. Shipments begin December 1st with delivery before Christmas. More information at putthison.com. And by Ask Metafilter. Thousands of life's little questions answered. Online at ask.metafilter.com. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the actor Patrick Warburton. Right after Seinfeld, you had what... God, it's hard for me to pick my favorite Patrick Warburton roles, but one of my all-time favorites, certainly, which was as the evil Johnny Johnson on the sitcom News Radio, a counterpart to Jimmy James... the boss on that show, who in a 3-episode arc in the final season of that show stole Jimmy James's corporate empire and Dave Foley's character's girlfriend, but then was destroyed by Jimmy James, and we later find out transformed into a bum, or as he prefers to be called, a wino, living on the streets. And I want to play this scene from the show. This is you've been discovered living in the subway with a sort of shifty gang of winos, and you've returned to Dave Foley's character's office. So you're in there dressed in full wino regalia, and Stephen Root, Jimmy James, the boss of bosses, comes in and finds you there.
Did I hear right? Is there a certain arch nemesis of mine that comes right here? Yeah, oh, Johnny! Son, you smell.
See, Johnny lives on the street now, sir.
Well, of course he lives on the street.
You're not surprised?
Nah, that's what happens when you empty a man's bank account, ruin his credit rating, blackball him so he can't ever get a job. I call it my deluxe severance package.
And, Johnny, you're not at all bitter about this?
No, why should he be? It's just business.
Don't you ever tangle with this guy, Dave. He will mess you up for good.
Yeah. So, what the hell are you doing right now?
I'm a wino.
Oh. Well, how's that treating you?
Funny you should ask. Last week, I got elected king of the winos.
Oh, how'd you hear that, Dave? King of the damn winos. Boy, oh boy. Can't keep a good man down, can you?
This is it's really one of my favorite things that's ever been on a television program, I have to tell you. But I imagine that it was also difficult because this was the final season of News Radio.
Yeah.
Which I think was a really wonderful season, as was the rest of the program, but very difficult because Phil Hartman had been killed in between that season and the previous one.
Yeah.
So I can imagine that it must have been, I've talked to Dave Foley about this, just a difficult place to be. All these brilliant people who were so close together, but also missing their friend.
Well, and he'd been taken with such tragic consequences in such a tragic way. And it just, there was a strange energy there, certainly. And then, you know, add the Andy Dick factor. You've got, it's just.
And
it's,
Andy Dick was pretty well along by that point. He had been successful and making good money for a long time and thus free to indulge in being Andy Dick.
Yes. It was bizarre. Now, John Lovitz was there. He came on. He was a good friend of Phil's. And he came on. I thought, well, it'd be interesting and weird. But, you know, John's there. I'll jump on board and we'll. You know, we'll try to have some fun here, and but it's tough to be on a set like that when it's all still so fresh, you know. And it wasn't like a comrade had just died. I mean, he was taken out in the horror stories of Hollywood, and it's so everybody was kind of slugging it out that season. Yet the writing, the story, it was fun. I look at that stuff, and it really was fun.
You couldn't find someone who loves the work of Phil Hartman more than me. But I have to say that your arcs and several other episodes from that last season are among my favorites on one of my favorite shows.
Oh. Wow. Well, thank you, Jesse. That's my praise, my friend.
What's interesting, what I like about that character is they took what I think has been the central quality of so many of your characters, which is that no matter how sort of uncomprehending or dopey or jerky you are, that you are somehow able to bring the audience along with you, which is a very special gift. You know, to have an audience like you when you're doing something horrible is a great gift for comedy. And they went all out and made that essentially the premise for that bit. The premise of those arcs is Dave Foley's character gets that you're a horrible person. In fact, that you're literally evil.
Yeah.
And no one else does. Like, everyone else is just too busy liking you.
It was so much fun. Sometimes just a perfectly writ character comes along, and you're like, this is great. I love it.
You did a movie right around then that I really liked. I think it was probably your first starring role in a movie called The Woman Chaser.
Yeah.
Which is, I think it's still not out on DVD, but I checked on Amazon. You can get it for $3 on VHS. I do recommend it.
There's a gentleman up in the Bay Area who runs the oldest art house in San Francisco, and they It's been around for about 100 years, and
this
he was
the
curious.
Roxy?
It's, I believe it is the Roxy.
Yeah, I only know it because I grew up like two blocks away.
Yeah. And he was curious why it wasn't on DVD. He'd gone to the DVD rental joint, the Artsy One, and he inquired about it. And the guy said, that's the number one requested DVD that we don't have and cannot get because it's not out there. The rights haven't been acquired to all the music, which is, I think, probably a couple $100,000. Now, I don't, you know... When you're talking about a little, you know, niche flick like this, a little, you know, cult movie that's obviously not going to, you know, get a ton of buys. It's, you know, mostly those in the art community or want to check it out. It's always a gamble to, you know, acquire, procure those rights and then put it out there. But I know they want to do it. I mean, he ended up screening The Woman Chaser this last year for an entire week and to some nice sold out houses, and everybody seemed to really really dig it. So I'd love to see it, you know, on DVD someday.
It's sort of a classic hard boiled LA story. You play a sort of aspiring movie maker in the vein of like a Mickey Spillane character or something like that. And I think that one of the really remarkable things about the movie is that it never breaks that tone. It never breaks that classic hard-boiled tone. But and you never break tone. You are as sincere as you could possibly be throughout the film, including during your ballet dancing scene, your extended ballet dancing scene. But there is, you have a quality about you that makes it funny. And I wonder if you've ever been frustrated by that quality, like wanted to go and do something really serious and you thought you were making dramatic choices and you found that people were laughing at you.
That's probably where Dragon Art changed my life, Jesse. there have been times, where I enjoy it just because I know that is one of the things that I got in my corner is that there's something just absurd about me and I don't know what the hell it is. I don't even know what it is, but it's great that I could, you know, be at that place where I'm seemingly taking myself seriously, but nobody else is. So it's fun. You know, I did a film called The Civilization Maxwell Bright where I did commit in there. I think it was pretty honest, you know. It's a gritty little film. Unfortunately, it was shot on PAL. So and that was one of my concerns at the time. I don't know why because that doesn't, I think even high def was an option to us, but we still shot on PAL. And it's not a perfect film, but I felt like there were great performances and I was proud of that. That was a departure for me, as was, I would say, you know, The Dish, which was an Australian film I did at the time. But those are the few times when I've gone in that direction where I don't think I've been, where people are laughing because I'm just stupid.
Your character is stupid because your character is stupid, Patrick. Yeah. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest on this show is actor Patrick Warburton. If his name doesn't sound familiar, his voice almost certainly does. He played Putty on Seinfeld, among many other television and film roles. You've been married for a long time, and you have four kids, and you're on a very kind of classic family/relationship sitcom on Rules of Engagement. And you're contrasted with your co-star David Spade. I actually want to play, this is, you explaining and then demonstrating, what you consider to be a relationship saving strategy, that you have used on your wife called the bank.
See, whenever Art screws up, instead of getting mad and shoving it in her face, I just deposit it into this handy file, the bank.
The bank?
That's right. Then when I screw up, I withdraw one of her old screw-ups to neutralize her anger.
That seems kind of petty and manipulative.
Thanks.
Great. You didn't mail that check, and now there are no more spots left in the class. Bet you never forget to mail a check to the Beer of the Month Club, do you?
First of all, I have that on auto-pay, and... You know, I said I was sorry, and people forget things. I mean, just by way of random example, a few weeks ago, you forgot to return that Mamma Mia DVD, and by the time we found it in the couch cushions, we owned it. For $80.
Well, that was...
Similar incident? Sure. But I only bring it up to show that people aren't perfect.
Well, that's true.
I don't think I even got mad at you.
No, you're actually pretty understanding.
So, I guess this is like a teachable moment.
I was at the Chateau Marmont once, yeah. Not trying to brag or anything. I have
it's a swanky quite joint.
Quite the Hollywood lifestyle.
Nice.
I've been there two times in my life. But David Spade was there. This was just, I'm going to say 2 years ago, a year or two ago. I like David Spade as much as the next guy. He's sitting there at dinner, with four women. I'm not going to say that they were definitely all models, but probably all models.
Yeah.
I just found myself like, it's not that he's not a good looking man, but he's not he's not George Clooney. His central quality is not his good lookingness. Not that he's not a successful man. He is a successful man, but again, he's not a film star or, you know what I mean? He's on a well-liked successful sitcom and he's well-liked in the world of comedy.
I think it, you know, his power with women is his humor and his charm, you know, and he's one of the funny, most spontaneously funny people that I've ever known. He's just, his mind is always working that way. And he's, you know, he's a charming guy. You know, you see him with all these beautiful girls it's pretty, you know, it could be a little astonishing, I guess, at times, you know, but I find myself less astonished. I get it. I see how he is as successful as he is.
You're on this show where you play a classic married guy on television. He plays a classic Lothario-ish guy on television. You are a married guy and have been for many years, 20 plus years, I guess, at this point. He lives that lifestyle,
yeah.
Apparently. I've seen it with my own eyes. I wonder if you've ever like looked at him and thought, wow, what would it be like for me to be 45 years old and living that life rather than,
well, I have, Jesse, I've said it out loud in print before, you know, it's gone to print and my wife's read it. And I've had hell to pay, you know, really for just, you know, every now and then, maybe I said, sure, for 1 month, it'd be nice to have David's lifestyle, that makes me a bad guy. Geez, I think any red-blooded American male would love to be in David's shoes for a little while.
But maybe for a little while.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been with my wife since we were 17. Yeah. So, you know, I'm sort of probably deeper into that than you are.
I have two, though, Jesse. Where's our get out of jail free card? Don't we get one? Let's go to Cabo and just see what kind of trouble we could get in down there for a week. Come on, Jesse.
But you seem like, I mean, you strike me as the kind of dude who is, you have four kids.
Yeah.
You know, you're, as you mentioned, your folks had four kids. Where having that kind of life is sort of what you want.
Well, I have the four best kids in the world, and I have the best wife in the world, you know?
You have four of the top five. I do have one kid.
I have four, like I said, of the top five. And, we have a good life and you go one direction or another, and that is the way that that I went and I look, and I know that there's much fulfillment there. You know, my kids, you know, as a parent, ultimately that becomes the only thing that's really of a concern for you is the safety and well-being of your children, of your family, and nothing else matters. You know, that's probably why we have three SUVs, you know, in our driveway. You know, I feel guilty in one sense, but I've always had my wife driving the kids around in a big SUV because that makes them all safe.
I wondered about the spikes on it. I thought that was a little bit much to put spikes on it. It's The Sound of Young America. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is the actor Patrick Warburton. So, Patrick, you've done the voice for a lot of animated characters on shows like Archer, which is one of my absolute favorites, and the Venture Brothers. But your first time doing this was for a Disney movie called The Emperor's New Groove. Let's take a listen to a clip from the movie. Here you are as Kronk, who is, people will be shocked to learn, dumb but lovable, helping Yzma attempt to poison the Emperor at dinner.
So, is everything ready for tonight?
Oh yeah, I thought we'd start off with soup and a light salad, and then see how we feel after that.
Not the dinner. The, you know.
Oh, right. The poison for Cusco. The poison chosen specially to kill Cusco. Cusco's poison. That poison?
Yes, that poison.
Got you covered.
Excellent. A few drops in his drink, then I'll propose a toast, and he will be dead before dessert.
Which is a real shame, because it's going to be delicious.
Boom, bam, baby. Let's get to the grub. I am one hungry king of the world.
Kronk, get the Emperor a drink.
Drink. Right.
I didn't know what a Kronk was. That's the character that I did. You know, because Disney's very secretive. I had three pages of a script. There was a Kronk and an Yzma, and I thought, well, this Kronk could be a robot or a monster, a troll. I don't know what the hell a Kronk is, but,
you know, I think a Kronk probably could sound like that. And I just decided to do, you know, talk like that.
And then I went in, and I liked it. And the next thing I know, I'm working on a Disney movie. For me, was just an amazing opportunity. Like, I grew up in Huntington Beach. I went to Disneyland my whole life growing up, and I'm a real Disney, I'm kind of a Disney junkie. I love Disneyland. I've always thought that it was much more than a theme, a park, or a studio. It's, you know, and that even though Walt's been long gone, that his, you know, it's a huge corporation now, but still the heart and soul of Walt Disney, I believe, lives there. It's, to me, it's a very spiritual place, and anytime I get a chance to work with Disney, you know, it thrills me. So even being the poor man's Buzz Lightyear, that was one of the first opportunities I got. Tim Allen's not going to do a TV show, right? So I'm like, I'll be your poor man's Buzz. Knowing very well how I felt growing up. Like when they do the TV series, you know, every kid's like, that's not the real guy. That sucks.
You're actually even at Disneyland. Well, at Disneyland California Adventure. And as I just found out at Disney World as well, you play, there's a ride where you fly over, at least in Disneyland California Adventure, you fly over like the wine country and the Golden Gate Bridge and stuff. You have this flying experience and you are the host of it. You're like the guy that you watch while people are standing in line.
Yeah.
Was that a job that you ended up doing because you had that affinity for that place?
I would hope to think that it somehow kind of gravitates towards you when, you know, you love it. It loves you. Maybe it's just nice to get those opportunities. I just got a call. I said, hey, would you be interested in being part of a Disney ride? I just thought that was amazing. So, and just recently I got asked to do the voice of the droid on the Star Tours ride.
Because as you were saying this, I was thinking like that my entire childhood ambition was to one day replace Paul Rubens, who did the original droid on the Star Tours ride, which was my favorite ride at Disneyland. Like that seemed like the greatest job in the world to me. And I found out it's been offered to you.
Well, no, that is, I'm a droid where when you're in line, you're waiting in line. I'm the security droid. So, like, a woman will walk by with a guy, and I'll be like, I'm sorry, no Wookiees allowed. Oh, that was your husband. My apologies. Ridiculous stuff like that. But they
a few robot zingers.
But then they robotize the voice, so it's hard to tell. But that was really fun. Yeah, I get to do that.
Yeah. I like the idea that you tell your agent, like, look, I've got this hit sitcom. I'm pretty busy. I've got a lot of important voiceover roles in critically lauded television programs. But if any Disney-related theme parks call asking for someone to perform a minor role as a wisecracking robot, put them through.
Absolutely.
Put them through.
Yeah. That's the pinnacle right there.
Well, Patrick Warburton, thank you so much for joining us on The Sound of Young America. It was really fun to have you on the show.
Hey, Jesse. Thanks for having me here.
Patrick Warburton is one of the stars of the sitcom Rules of Engagement. He also plays a talk show host, if talk show hosts were horrible, horrible people, in the Cracked series, Effin' With Tonight. That's our time for another Sound of Young America program. I have been your host, Jesse Thorne. The show produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer, Julia Smith. Our editor is Nick White. Our intern is Colin Walzak. That's Colin with two L's for those of you keeping score at home. If you have thoughts about the show, you can always send me an email. My email address is jesse@maximumfun.org. And always remember, all good radio hosts have a signature sign-off.